TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Jeffrey Sachs on BRICS, New Currency Unveiled, Iran-Israel War and World War III. Danny Haifong interviews Jeffrey Sachs on the 2024 BRICS Summit. The annual BRICS Summit was held on October 22nd to 24 in Russia's southwestern city of Kazan. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The group started in 2006 and has since doubled in numbers. This was the first BRICS summit to include Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates as members. 13 nations have now been added as partner countries of BRICS: Algeria, Belarus, Bolivia, Cuba, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, Nigeria, Thailand, Turkey, Uganda, Uzbekistan, and Vietnam. The aim of the BRICS alliance is to challenge the economic and political monopoly of the West. So-called Western governments and analysts and podcasters are now trying to make sense of what this huge growth of BRICS members and partners means, and how it might affect the role of the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency. Professor Jeffrey Sachs is an American economist, public policy analyst, and director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. He has worked as an economic advisor to governments in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Professor Sachs was interviewed by the activist, writer, and political analyst Danny Haifong. He has been a weekly contributor to Black Agenda Report since 2018, and his articles have been published by Mint Press News and Counterpunch. Haifong publishes interviews on global geopolitical events on his YouTube channel, Geopolitics Haifong. Here's his interview with Professor Jeffrey Sachs from October 24, 2024.
I wanted to ask your opinion and reaction to what has been a momentous BRICS summit. Specifically, there has been a lot of news coming out of this summit. There has been a BRICS Pay demo, as well as a symbolic gesture of a BRICS currency being unveiled, and a lot of talk about reforming the financial system, the world financial system, and a lot of talk in the Western media about how Putin is not so isolated. There's been a lot of, from Bloomberg to BBC, talking about Vladimir Putin's presidency of the BRICS this year, showing how all these measures against Russia taken by the West have been failing, and in particular, this question of Russia being isolated.
Well, maybe it's a good place to start with the West, so-called. What do we mean by the West? It's not exactly a geographical description. It means essentially the U.S.-led alliance in the world, mainly a military alliance, but also, of course, an economic alliance of sorts. And the West is the United States and Canada, Britain, the European Union, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and a handful of other countries. And when you add it up, it's not a lot of the world. As I've mentioned, 27 EU countries, Canada and the United States makes 29, Britain makes 30, Japan, Korea, 32, Australia, New Zealand makes 34. Throw in another six or so, you could throw in another 10 tiny island economies around the world that are, for one reason or another, tied to the U.S. or even in formal ways, like Micronesia. But when you add up the population, the U.S. is 335 million people, the EU, 450 million people, that's 800 million. Add in the rest, and maybe you're at 1.1 or 1.2 billion people in the West. And that is, in an 8 billion person world, about 15% of the world population. So where are the rest of the people? Well, of course, China and India, that's 2.8 billion right there. Africa, another 1.4 billion, that's 4.2 billion. So the African Union plus India plus China is more than half the world. And they're not part of the West. And when you then add in the rest of the developing world, the ASEAN countries, for example, 10 countries in Southeast Asia with a population of about 800 million people, the Central Asian countries, the West Asian countries, which are basically the Arab countries of the Middle East, plus Iran and a few others. Well, this is where the other 85% of the world ends up being, and they're not part of the Western world. There has been, of course, a certain hubris of the West for a long time. I'd say it's at least 200 years old that the West runs the world. That's coming to an end because not only do the population numbers not add up, but the GDP numbers don't add up either anymore. If you measure GDP, as I think is appropriate in many contexts, by what we call purchasing power adjusted dollars, China's already 25 or 30% larger than the United States economy in the aggregate, not per person, because it's four times the population, but in the aggregate. So now I can turn to the BRICS. The BRICS is 9 or 10 countries right now. There's a little bit of ambiguity, in my mind at least, of exactly where Saudi Arabia is in this situation, but they're going to add more. And in the meeting today, that was a head of state, mainly roundtable discussion, there were 36 countries around the table. Those 36 countries, I added it up just earlier, was 57% of the world population just at the table. Measured in purchasing power prices, it was 46% of world output at the table. In other words, this is really a very significant part of the world. It's a larger part of the world than the Western world, in fact. Now, the West has believed that it dominates, and within the West, the United States believes it dominates because of its dominant military power, which is no doubt very strong. But what we see on the battlefield in Ukraine shows that it's not so dominant. Russia is actually, of course, defeating Ukraine on the battlefield. I say, of course, because it was completely predictable. The numbers are on Russia's side when it comes to military forces, not a surprise. But the NATO countries, and led by the United States, have poured in a lot, tens of billions of dollars of very sophisticated armaments, but nothing that was in the slightest decisive in defeating Russia. So this idea that the West, even if it doesn't dominate in population numbers or in GDP shares anymore, it still dominates in military power, not so true. And we're seeing also with Israel and its mass destructive power, no doubt, in Gaza and in Lebanon. But Israel's not defeating even Hamas. It's not defeating Hezbollah. It certainly is not going to win a direct war with Iran, where the population is more than 10 times larger. And Iran is a very sophisticated military power with ballistic missiles, with hypersonic missiles, and with a strong alliance with Russia. So all of this shows that we arrived before our eyes at a different world in the last 10 years. And it's happening right now. And the BRICS is this story, that the dominance of the West, which it's a little hard to date precisely. It's at least, of course, been since 1800. Arguably, it's been since 1700, because from 1700 onward, the West won all the wars that it was in with the rest of the world, by not all of them, but by and large, it was able to take territory, win colonies, and so forth, until after World War II. And the West has felt, well, this is a Western-led world. that's over. And the BRICS is a vivid sign of it being over.
Yes, yes, of course. And at the summit, the BRICS countries weren't really talking about Ukraine. There was also, of course, statements made about what's happening in Gaza and West Asia. But at the same time, there was a lot more talk about development, about trade, and about how, especially in the case of these countries like Iran, like Russia and China, how all of these countries that were at the table are going to work together for a more prosperous and multipolar world. Putin and Xi Jinping met on the sidelines. Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi met on the sidelines, and they struck a historic deal on the border tensions in, that they have between those two countries. So talk about how we got here, because there seems to be a completely different trajectory being charted, and it's being led by Russia and China, and yet and Iran as well, and India. But many of these countries have received the ire of the West, and yet it doesn't seem to be working.
Well, I think there are two senses of the question, how did we get here? One is, how is it that the non-Western world has made so much advance in technology, military power, state organization, economic size? And the second question is, how is it that the BRICS went from a label given by an economist at Goldman Sachs, different Sachs, by the way, just to be clear, at Goldman Sachs, to a geopolitical entity? So two different points. But the first one I want to mention is that all of economic history, dating back 2,000 years plus, shows that at various points, one region of the world gains some technological advantage and is able even to conquer other major parts of the world. But the advantage that made those conquests possible are not permanent advantages, because the conquered nations learn from them, technologies diffuse, other innovations take hold, and so nobody stays on top forever. And when you look at the Western-led world, the West was not in the lead in the world. The West, meaning Western Europe in particular, was a kind of appendage of Eurasia for a long time. During the Roman Empire in Western Europe, of course, it was a very powerful unit. But if you looked at the year 1000 AD, the West was coming out of still the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, whereas in the East, you had great empires and sophistication and a larger knowledge base and more philosophy and arts and other things occurring. So there was no sense in which the West was ahead. The West begins to show its role after the so-called voyages of discovery, if you want to call them that, of Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama, 1498 and 1492, respectively, and the beginning of European colonial footprints in other parts of the world. But still, India and China were in many, many ways technologically more sophisticated even then. When the Industrial Revolution came and the key invention of the steam engine being made into an extremely powerful, practical, versatile instrument that could be used for war, for factory production, for transport, and for countless other things, this was the decisive breakthrough to the modern economy. And it happened first in Britain and then in Western Europe and the United States. And so it was industrialization in the 19th century that was the great, great advantage of the West, the decisive advantage. And it led to European imperialism in the 19th century and growing US imperialism in the 20th century. But very broadly speaking, without going into every nook and cranny of economic history, World War I and World War II shattered many things, ideas, systems, politics, lives, but also the European imperial system. which by the end of World War II was basically on its path of coming to an end by and large. There are still little, there are still colonies around, but not the big ones. India gained independence, Indonesia gained independence, and so forth in the late 1940s, and then onward with the wars of liberation of Vietnam and other places. What happened with independence was these formerly brutalized and colonized places introduced education systems, literacy, infrastructure, and said, hell, we don't want that again. We want to catch up. And this is by and large what has happened from 1950, instead of what economists would call the age of divergence, where the rich got richer and the poor got snookered and colonized, which was roughly from 1800 to 1950. From 1950 onward, the former colonies began a catching up process, some completely dramatic, others not quite as successful, but broadly in the same path. And China's was the most successful from 1980 to 2020, because growth was compound roughly 10% per year for 40 years. And that's more than a 30-time increase of aggregate output. And in the meantime, China moved up the technology ladder right to the forefront of global technology. This is the single biggest game changer of all, but it's part of a more general process. Now comes your question, how did the BRICS come about as a counterweight to the West? In some sense, nobody liked the Western era of dominance when they were colonized. So I think there's a lot of historical latent resentment anyway. And why not? Because the Western world was a nasty world. It was a racist world. It was a dominating world. It was a greedy world. It was an extractive world. It was a hypocritical world. All of those things absolutely apply. But there was a sense, okay, that's the world, you know, so we don't have to be against all of that. But the United States, to summarize, got pretty obnoxious over the last 40 years. You know, I'm not a fan of U.S. foreign policy. I think it's been utterly nasty and self-defeating. I say nasty because it's based on wars of choice and regime change operations and sanctions, unilateral sanctions that the U.S. puts on to tell other countries what to do. It's not based on diplomacy. It's based on bossing other countries around, not necessarily its own immediate allies in the West, so-called, but in the rest. And so the U.S. foreign policy has been quite obnoxious. Dozens and dozens of regime change operations, wars of choice nonstop, CIA-led efforts to topple regimes around the world. The more you know, and by now I know a lot, it's deeply unpleasant. And it doesn't work. It does destabilize other places, but it doesn't serve any U.S. purpose, doesn't raise my security, doesn't raise my wealth. All it did was generate $7 trillion of war costs since 2000. And that was funded basically by borrowing from the U.S. So our debt soared to reach about 100% of GDP because we had stupid wars in Iraq and Syria and Libya and Ukraine, in Afghanistan, for nothing. The BRICS is a reaction to that too, because the United States has pursued an aggressive hegemonic policy, basically trying to hold on to its dominance, even as the underlying economic reality is something quite different now. And that's what the U.S. doesn't understand. They need to get out of their offices and understand the world. We aren't in a Western-led world anymore. We're not in a U.S.-led world anymore. But the U.S. is trying to hang on, just like France did in North Africa for a while, just like France did in Indochina for a while. But it's an absolutely losing effort. And this is what the BRICS have noted, and actually why there are 36 countries around the table today representing more than half the world population.
Including Turkey, a NATO member, which was a huge development in and of itself. And I wanted to ask you, Professor Sachs, do you believe that BRICS, given how much it's expanding, its popularity. It's even Antonio Gutierrez was there representing the United Nations, which was really a historic moment in and of itself too. Do you feel that BRICS is going to succeed in doing what many people are wondering about, which is supplanting and creating a new alternative financial architecture and structure to ultimately get away from what Chinese President Xi Jinping, what Russian President Vladimir Putin, and what many countries who are interested in joining BRICS have been talking about, which is the weaponization of the dollar and dollar dominance?
So again, a big question. I have a general point, which is that the U.S. has been the main hegemon in the world for basically nearly 80 years since the end of World War II, but that period's over. I personally do not believe that China will be the new hegemon. I think we are now in a truly multipolar world. There will be a number of major powers, the United States remaining one of them, the EU, if it holds together, being one, Russia, China, India, and maybe the African Union in 20 years will look like a geostrategic leader as well. It's not impossible. So I think we're in a multipolar world. I don't think that the West is going away, or I don't think that it's going to succumb to China's dominance, because I don't think, first of all, that China wants dominance. I don't think it's possible for China to be the world hegemon in any event, not in a military sense and not in many other senses. And it's an important footnote to add that China's population today is 1.4 billion, but by the end of the century, it could well be below 1 billion because the fertility rates are so far below replacement level that China's population has peaked and is now declining. The same is kind of true with the dollar. The dollar has been the hegemonic currency, not unrelated to America's political hegemony as well. It will no longer be the hegemonic currency. There will be multiple currencies. I don't think the renminbi will supplant the dollar, but it will absolutely live alongside the dollar as a major world currency. And I doubt that there will be a BRICS currency anytime soon. There may be a BRICS unit of account, like the SDR is a formal unit of account. It's a basket of currencies where the units are defined by the IMF and used in IMF accounting and in some denomination of credits and so forth. And maybe the BRICS will have a similar kind of basket and accounting, and maybe it could show up even in some bonds and in some lending and so forth. But I don't think there will be a unique BRICS currency for quite a while, if ever. So what I think we're moving towards is a multi-currency system, just like we're moving towards a multipolar system. And one of the reasons that the U.S. has accelerated this is essentially the same answer I gave about the geopolitics. The U.S. government has been absolutely obnoxious in how it's misused money. It's a privilege when other countries use your money. You get to borrow very cheap, by the way, even just printing notes that they hold because they're dealing with your currency. So you get what we call seniorage returns. But if you suddenly go out and confiscate the bank holdings of other governments, like we did with Russia, freezing $300 billion of Russian government assets, or you do that with Venezuela, or you do that with Iran, or you do that with Afghanistan, well, there are many ways to transact. You don't have to hold dollars. You know, if I were not on good terms with the USG as being a different government, I wouldn't hold dollars either.
Professor Sachs, my last question to you has to do with Israel and this creeping war with Iran. There's still Yoav Gallant and Israeli officials talking about how this strike will be hard and it will be damaging. I'm curious on your assessment of what is coming here between Israel and Iran, and of course the U.S.'s role.
First, it's important to say that Netanyahu has been campaigning for a U.S. war with Iran at least for 30 years. This has been a pet project of Netanyahu. Netanyahu is one of the world's leading political disaster cases, and his influence over the U.S. has been utterly disastrous for the United States. He played a major role in talking the Bush administration into invading Iraq in 2003 on phony pretenses, no less. And he played a major role in encouraging Obama to try to topple Assad in Syria. The man wants the U.S. to take out Israel's enemies that are opposed to Israel's assertion of what it wants, regional hegemony. It wants to be able to control all of the occupied lands, never give back anything, annex them, settle wherever. And Israel has made lots of enemies because of this. And then Netanyahu's answer is, well, we can't really just fight Hamas and Hezbollah. We have to fight the backers. That means the governments. Well, Israel's big talker. Netanyahu is full of it. But his idea has been to engage the U.S. in Israel's wars. And he's had success in that, except these wars have been complete disasters. And he wants the U.S. to fight a war with Iran now. Iran doesn't want to fight. The U.S. doesn't want to fight. Netanyahu wants to fight. The Israel lobby backs Netanyahu. The Congress gives him 58 standing ovations when that guy comes and appears, rather than the shame that he should have received by the United States, and the Congress never should have invited him to speak in the first place. After all, the prosecutor of the ICC recommended his indictment for war crimes. So what's the U.S. Congress doing inviting this guy? Anyway, he's been a complete disaster for the U.S., but also for Israel. And so the whole campaign that Netanyahu has had for 30 years, instead of going for the two-state solution and a state of Palestine living in peace next door to Israel, instead of going for that, he's gone for control of everything and regime change, but all with the U.S. doing his bidding.
That was Professor Jeffrey Sachs, economist, writer, political analyst, and director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. Thanks to Danny Haifong for the interview that was posted live on his YouTube channel, Geopolitics Haifong, on October 24, 2024. The full interview involves two more speakers, and the title is Jeffrey Sachs, Richard Wolff, and Victor Gao, BRICS, New Currency Unveiled, Iran-Israel War, and World War III Looms. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.